From 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR, this is Lake Effect. I'm Audrey Nowakowski. Today, we'll explore the status of the real estate market in the Milwaukee area. Then, we'll learn what makes for an easy walk and how two sisters created a guidebook for accessible walks here in the city.
Jenny and I both like walking in parks, and I mentioned the project to Jenny, and I think we kind of weighed the possibilities of like, well, do you think we could find 50 fun walks in the city of Milwaukee? And then we set out to see if we could.
Plus, we'll meet the director and part subject of the documentary, Chasing Chasing Amy.
People thought organically that I should include my personal story with Chasing Amy in the film, but I was interested in like an almost anthropological lens of like, what does Chasing Amy mean to LGBTQ people? And what does that dissonance say about us?
All that's coming up on Lake Effect. But first, here are today's headlines. This is Lake Effect from 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR. I'm Audrey Nowakowski. Thanks for joining us. Today, we'll learn about the positive and thorny legacy that the film Chasing Amy has in the LGBTQ community. And we'll speak with a filmmaker about why the cult classic changed his life. We'll start with a look at the real estate market in the Milwaukee area. Since the pandemic, it has consistently been a seller's market. Here in Milwaukee, demand has been high while the housing supply remains low. Add in high interest rates, and it's created a difficult environment for people looking to buy a home in our area. The housing market is tight across the country, but Milwaukee presents some unique challenges that some other cities aren't facing. To break down the current real estate market, Lake Effect's Joy Powers is joined by Chris Drosner, the executive editor of Milwaukee Magazine, which published a look at the housing market this month.
So right now, how would you describe Milwaukee's real estate market?
Well, it's hot, and it's only constrained from being hotter by a lack of supply. You know, the big question that we were pondering as we were planning this package of stories and weren't really sure what the answer was at the time was, what would these higher interest rates that we're seeing now compared to the last few years, would that be slowing things down or depressing prices? And the answer is not really. They are in a way, in that because of the higher interest rates, people are tending to stay in their homes to basically, you know, carry forward that low interest rate that they have from a few years ago or a refi recently or whatever that might be. But because of that, they're not eager to sell their home and jump into the market and pay, you know, an interest rate that might be 3 or 4 points higher than what they've got. So that's pretty remarkable that in spite of that reduced supply, everything's going as hot as it is. Interest rates bottomed out in January 2021 at like 2.65%. So just to kind of put that in perspective, you could buy at that time, if you bought a $400,000 house, which is roughly average in the metro area here, put 20% down and had kind of a typical, you know, typical tax and insurance payments, you'd end up with a monthly mortgage payment of about $2,289. And if you apply that to today's rate environment at about 7%, you'd be looking at $3,129. So that's almost $900 higher. That's some significantly diminished buying power. So, you know, having buyers just kind of powering through that is, I think, pretty remarkable. And it's a testament to the demand that's out there.
Well, and that's a really big change in, you know, 3 years, really. I think the big question for a lot of potential home buyers right now is why? Why are things so seemingly crazy in the real estate market?
It comes down to that lack of supply. There's just not enough listings out there. Last year, listings were down about 15% from the previous year. And so far this year, they're essentially flat. So not really new houses coming online. So people just can't find homes. You know, when you're doing that rate calculus of like, well, what would my payment be if I'm going to sell? You know, typically sellers are not just selling, they're also buying into the market. So if you're in a position where you can sell and not buy, then you can really cash in. But most sellers aren't doing that. The option of switching over to a rental property for your home isn't super appealing either, because, you know, Milwaukee was one of the most competitive and highest growth as far as rent environments in the entire country last year. So the realtors say that it's not a hot market because there's just not as many sales happening. But from a buyer's perspective, it is extremely hot because everything's so competitive that you really have to be aggressive to get a home.
What are some of the constraints on this growth here? Because it seems like, you know, there's a lack of supply. You would imagine that people who build homes are going, great, I will supply more homes. I'll build more homes. But it doesn't seem like we're seeing that happening.
That's been an issue for sure in this market. Building costs have been really high for the last several years. We've seen costs about just about everything climb. And so, you know, most of what we're looking at is existing home sales versus new home sales. And there's just not enough new homes out there to satisfy the demand. You know, people want to live here and there's really not enough housing.
Yeah, you know, it's one of those situations where it's great to be desirable, but once people get there, they need to be able to see themselves able to grow there, able to change there if need be. And when there isn't that kind of flexibility in the market, it becomes less likely.
Yeah. And, you know, I mean, our story focused very much on like real estate and buying a home, selling a home, gets into a little bit into renting. But obviously when these costs are increasing so much, people are getting priced out. And when you have people getting priced out of even rental properties, that's obviously a big problem.
Now, if you're someone who is starting the home buying process in Milwaukee, what does that look like? What is that process like right now?
It's very personal, you know, as you might imagine. Everybody's kind of looking for different things. We profiled a few different buyers kind of in different points in their life journey. You know, we had a first-time couple buying their first home. We had a couple moving from downtown out into the suburbs. We had somebody looking to upsize from a solid house to kind of a bigger, probably a luxury type property. So everybody kind of wants different things. You know, maybe it's like location is really important. There might be certain features like a great kitchen or really special entertaining space. You know, you might want a backyard for the dog. But, you know, one thing that was a common thread through all these stories was the need to be aggressive. Like, for example, one couple that we looked at, they liked their home in Whitefish Bay so much that they put in an offer that was, wait for it, $300,000 above the asking price. Another basically made their decision just within a matter of hours, where they found out that this house was available. Their realtor called them. As soon as they looked at the listing, you know, their realtor was like, they're taking offers at 6:00, and it was like 3:00 or something. The thread there is the need to act quickly and decisively.
Sure. Now, I myself went through the home buying process a couple of years back now, and it was similarly an aggressive and immediate, you know, oh, you like this house? You got to get out there. You got to put your offer in. And often just, you know, in some cases, dozens of other offers that were coming in on a single home. What are the kinds of tips for people who are looking for a home right now, who really need to find their new place? What are the tips that you learned from people who are in this industry?
Some of them are things that I think people probably already know or have heard. You know, getting a pre-approval letter is pretty pro forma now, but there is an advantage to getting pre-approved with a local lender, because that helps give the buyer and the buyer's agent peace of mind that they know, you know, they're going to know people, the title people are going to, you know, everything. It's kind of like an insurance policy that everything's going to kind of go smoothly, or at least a signal that everything's going to go smoothly. The other is an agent, you know, making sure you get a realtor who you trust, which is hard to know from an ad or whatever. You want to ask around for people you know. Did they have a good experience? What was, you know, what are you looking for in your realtor? You know, there's people, different real agents that specialize in kind of different things. And, you know, that can really be important in writing your offer, guiding you through this process that might be kind of sudden and scary. And, you know, having somebody you trust there to walk you through it and have somebody at your side and who's got your back. And the other one is kind of unique to this moment, and that's just kind of accept this interest rate environment for what it is and bite the bullet. The real estate pros who we talk to, they have the long view on this, and that is that the outlier in the last 20 years or 30 years, or pretty much go back as far as you want, was the super low sub threes or around 3% interest rates. My folks can tell you about being thrilled to get a 12% mortgage, you know, back in the 80s. So most of the outlooks look to have, you know, rates between 6 and 7.5% through the rest of this year. It was up a little bit. The most recent I saw just over 7.15%, which is a little higher than it was when we putting this issue to bed at 7. So, you know, that's all kind of tracking right now. There's an election coming up that could affect things, and volatility is not great for interest rates. So this might be as good as it's going to get. And it doesn't seem like there's a lot of relief coming in the near future. So if you need to buy a house, it might be as good a time as any.
All right. Well, Chris, thank you so much for joining us here on Lake Effect and sharing your work.
It's a pleasure, Joy. Thanks.
Chris Drosner is the executive editor of Milwaukee Magazine. He edited their feature story this month on the real estate market. He spoke with Lake Effect's Joy Powers. This week, we're celebrating Earth Day by exploring different ways our community is making the outdoors more accessible. A new book goes back to the basics, A Walk in the Park. It's called Easy Walks and Paddles in Milwaukee. The sisters Karen and Jennifer Lemke went to over 50 parks to find friendly walks, noting things like their accessibility, bathroom access, and whether they're easy to get to on the bus. With their book, the sisters hope to serve people with mobility issues or visual impairments, as well as elders and parents with young kids. WUWM's Lena Tran went on a walk with the Lemke sisters in Bayview's Humboldt Park. But first, she speaks with Marjorie Turner Holman, the editor of the Easy Walk series.
There's a few things that make a walk an easy walk. The idea comes from Marjorie Turner Holman, a writer in Bellingham, Massachusetts, who edits the Easy Walk series.
Not too many roots or rocks, relatively level with firm footing, and something of interest along the way. Water views, cool rocks, has nothing to do with distance because that's individual stamina. For any of us like me, who has mobility challenges, trail surfaces make the difference whether you can access an area or not.
30 years ago, Holman had a life-saving brain surgery that left her paralyzed on her right side. Easy walks became a huge part of her recovery journey.
I overlook a lake here in Bellingham, and there's a little dead-end road. I walked there almost daily, walking as far as I could, typically walking with friends. It was about 7 years of just walking in one place.
For Holman, walking wasn't just about physical health. It was a meditation on the world around her and what it means to be able to move.
I don't love exercise. I love being out in the world. I love what it does to me to just be outdoors, feel the wind, hear the birds, see the little changes. When you're there every day, you really do see those. You know, there's a lot if you're willing to look close.
Holman and Karen Lemke met online in a Zoom meeting last year. Holman had been wanting to add an urban field guide to the series. Until now, most of the books have been focused on Massachusetts, where she lives. I recently met Karen and her sister Jennifer at Humboldt Park. Here's Karen.
I'll review a book. So as I was reading one of her other books about easy walks and paddles, I realized, oh, this is really interesting, and this is something Jenny and I both like, walking in parks, and I mentioned the project to Jenny, and I think we kind of weighed the possibilities of like, well, do you think we could find 50 fun walks in the city of Milwaukee? And then we set out to see if we could.
What has the easy walk come to mean to you after putting this guide together?
I feel like it's kind of synonymous with, like, disability rights. Like, and the importance of thinking about all ability levels and all needs when designing public infrastructure like parks.
All the walks that you guys found are accessible by public transit. Yeah. Why was that such a priority for putting this together?
Yeah, my spouse and I decided to go down to one car like maybe 7-8 years ago. So that's just kind of how I think and plan about getting things done. So when Karen and I started doing this project, it was like, well, that's how I'm going to get to these parks. Like, I'm not going to take our car when she's at work. And, you know, that's not unique. There's tons of people in this city and outside of the city who are navigating without a car. So why wouldn't we focus on what's accessible to everybody?
We've also considered how public transit is part of a just transition climate solution. And the more we can normalize everyone using public transit, to me, the transit system in Milwaukee is one of our greatest assets. It's one of, you know, the things that being able to get around without having to have your own car is part of what the future looks like.
So you mentioned, Karen, I think, that you guys would do this, like, you would choose a new park to go on a walk weekly and, like, take notes in your phones. Just tell me about the process of putting this together.
So Jennifer and I started researching parks, researching meaning going for a walk and then having a snack, researching parks in earnest in June and July. At first, I had printed out a bunch of pieces of paper for us to take notes on. And then I realized, wait, if I could do the, you know, if I could automate this somehow with our phones, that would make this a lot easier. And we'd also be able to include a snapshot, a photo from each of the parks. I made a Google form, and then we were able to do data entry, so to speak, which spit it all into a spreadsheet. And then also, because it was already like a data table and it had the addresses in it, I was able to put that into Google Maps. And then we now have an interactive map as well.
They spent the next 5 months scoping out parks together. The sisters took note of things like trail surfaces, nearby bus stops, whether there are bathrooms or benches to rest on.
I just want to point out, as we're walking on this paved path, we just walked over a section of repaired concrete. That's certainly a concern that comes up, is that paved areas are not going to be safe if they are not maintained paved areas. And people who use mobility assistance, if they have a wheelchair or a cane or anything, it's, you know, much nicer to have maintained spaces.
The sisters also describe interesting views and history and suggest nearby spots to get a bite to eat after your walk.
I love that you guys have suggested snacks for each spot because I'm very food motivated. Where did that idea come from? Because I don't think that was like part of Marjorie's initial like vision,
no,
right?
It wasn't. Because we would go and hit up two or three parks in a row and then be like, okay, I'm starving and we don't know this neighborhood, so where are we going to go now? And then we're both kind of health conscious people. I've been vegetarian for 14 years, so sometimes it's like, where am I going to go?
Yeah.
So we started like, okay, if we're going to go explore this neighborhood, where are we going to eat? Who's got the vegetables?
Yeah. As you're putting this together, did you observe anything about like where parks are in the city or whether some parks are easier to get to in some parts of the city than others?
Yeah,
you know, what were some of your observations?
For sure. So let me talk a little bit about Frederick Law Olmsted, who was the landscape architect who designed Central Park and the three early parks in the Milwaukee system. And he was very committed to accessibility, including transit accessibility. To him, it was also very important for people from all different social backgrounds, social classes, ethnicities. He had visited the South before the Civil War and had written about the conditions that enslaved people were in. Really was part of what groundswelled the abolitionist movement in the 19th century. Anyway, so there's some of that history underlies the patterns of our park. So there's some, you know, beautiful intentions 130 years ago that as the city built out, places that were kind of intentionally marginalized, redlined, and through deed restrictions and other kinds of racialized ways of sort of saying these places are for us and these places aren't for you, there are certainly places on the north and northwest side that, and the south side too, that have less access to parks. But in general, 90% of people in the city of Milwaukee have access to a park within 1 mile. And the 10% who don't are in predominantly African-American neighborhoods.
Did any work on this project change how you see walks in your life or see public parks in the city?
I feel more obligated to be more involved, I don't want to say politically, but like with the local government and preserving these parks. I think this project has really opened our eyes to just how much has been put into building this thriving, comprehensive park system. And yet you can see in the more underserved neighborhoods, it's kind of starting to break down a bit. And there's, I just feel pressure to preserve what we've invested in, you know, and not let it fall into disrepair to the point beyond repair where people start saying, well, no, let's not give any money to the parks. Look what they've let happen to that park.
Karen and Jennifer say their book is a showcase of the city that they know and love.
Because I do get just tired of hearing the negative talk that comes from the suburbs from people who don't know what they're talking about.
It's a simple field guide, but with it, they're honoring the city's history and sharing a vision for the future.
I've been thinking about like colonialism and the structures of sort of what's been built upon, like, you know, layers of civilizations built upon each other, and how we erase, you know, culturally, and its function of whiteness and all that stuff, to just pretend that there was nothing in Milwaukee before Solomon Juneau got here. And so I also wanted to like tell the story about, you know, there were amazing Native American villages here. A bunch of these diagonal roads, they are Native American walking paths that connect these ancient villages that predate Solomon Juneau by 200 years. We are a thriving multi-ethnic city, and I see that as such an asset. You know, I feel like that's the future, that this is the city I want to live in. This is the kind of future that I want to build and work towards. And if this book can be part of the conversation about accessibility, about you know, recognizing that we need to make sure that our built environment is inclusive of everyone, I'd be overjoyed if our book could do that.
That's Karen and Jennifer Lemke. Their new book is Easy Walks and Paddles in Milwaukee. For Lake Effect, I'm Lena Tran.
Karen and Jennifer Lemke made an online map highlighting all the parks that they visited. You can find that and more information at WUWM.com. This week, we're celebrating Earth Day by exploring different ways our community is making the outdoors more accessible. Tomorrow, we'll tell you about Medicine Fish, an organization dedicated to enhancing the quality of life for Indigenous youth through revitalizing their cultural connection to the earth. The Republican National Convention is coming to Milwaukee in July. You can help shape our coverage by filling out our election survey. You can find a link to that at WUWM.com. What you tell us will help inform the stories that you hear on Lake Effect and WUWM. Coming up later in the show, we'll speak with Franco Stevens, the founder of Curve Magazine. The documentary all about the world's most successful lesbian magazine just became available to stream on Netflix this week.
I really started the magazine because I wanted it, and I was tired of complaining that somebody else should do it. And once I really, you know, accepted the fact that this was sort of my fate, I just knew it was going to happen.
But first, we'll speak with the filmmaker about why they wanted to make a documentary about the positive and negative legacy the 90s indie film Chasing Amy has on the LGBTQ community. That's coming up on Lake Effect on Milwaukee's NPR. Listening to Lake Effect on 89.7 WUWM. I'm Audrey Nowakowski. When 12-year-old Sav Rogers saw the 1997 Kevin Smith film Chasing Amy for the first time, his life was forever changed. He developed not just a soft spot for the film, but a slight obsession as he rewatched it constantly to help him get through the challenges of life as a queer kid living in Kansas. However, there is a thorny legacy to Chasing Amy, a film about a straight man who falls in love with a lesbian, especially for the LGBTQ+ community. Rogers explores the many sides of this legacy through his documentary, Chasing Amy. It provides a new outlook on this complicated classic indie, both for himself and the people involved in making it. It's playing in the Milwaukee Film Festival, and ahead of its last screening, Rogers joins me now to share how this film came to be.
I had the idea for a documentary about Chasing Amy since 2015, a year shortly after I'd started making short films in college. And I initially thought that, you know, it was too niche and that nobody would care about this but me and maybe Kevin Smith if I did a good job. And, you know, I just started like toying with it more. And, you know, eventually I opened up to a handful of people that I was interested in actually making this, including Bradley Garrison, one of our DPs, and Drew Burbridge, one of our executive producers. And they were both really encouraging at a very early stage in the process, saying that they thought that it had legs and that my personal connection was compelling. And so for a while, I was just, you know, applying to artist programs because I was finding some success in getting a lot out of like that artist development pipeline support. So in my pursuit, I just got this Facebook ad for the TED residency. And their whole initiative was to try to get younger people into the program through Adobe 1324. And so I just kept getting this really persistent Facebook ad. And I thought, all right, well, it costs nothing to apply. It's an hour out of my life to do the application. I attached my director's reel and a very general idea for a TED talk about, you know, the power of LGBTQ media representation. And to my surprise, I became a finalist for it with virtually no preparation. I was like, all right, well, I'll take the meeting, you know, and see what happens. And what ended up happening was this like just lovely organic conversation with Cindy Stivers, one of the head curators over at TED, Katrina Conan and Real, who used to run the TED residency program, and Jordan, the intern. And we were just talking about Chasing Amy, and they were like, all right, so, you know, if you had to give a TED talk tomorrow, what would it be about? I told them about this pitch for the movie, and they paused for a minute and said, that is the most specific, narrow idea for a TED talk we've ever heard. And, you know, you'll find out in 3 weeks if you got it. 3 days later, I learned I was getting paid to move to New York and to start the research portion of Chasing Amy. And it was there where we had our first 2 days of shooting. Our first day was in TED headquarters, but they also allowed me to like develop my voice more. It got 3 months to just develop the project and the process and to really hone my personal story, because I had never really talked about any of that publicly before. And I was really nervous too. But the support and the mentorship I received at TED, I will be forever grateful for.
Can you talk about kind of battling that sensibility with yourself? What's like, as a filmmaker, you take a lens that is outward, like big picture in what you want to share to the audience. So was there several moments where you were encouraged to be like, let's bring your voice into this more? And did you have some reluctance with yourself and had an internal battle to shape that direction?
100%. I wanted to tell the story, not be the story. And so the outset of the project, I was not interested in being in it whatsoever. But, you know, there were, every time I would talk about the project or pitch it, people would say, well, you're going to be in it, right? And so that was an early indicator that, you know, people thought organically that I should include my personal story with Chasing Amy in the film. But I was interested in like an almost anthropological lens of like, what does Chasing Amy mean to LGBTQ people? And what does that dissonance say about us? How can this thing that saved my life be, you know, so controversial among other people in my community? And it was, you know, it was just like a basic premise that I was hoping would branch out into saying something more about us as people. And that was not the story that everybody else wanted to tell. And when they were joining up on the project, it was either that they were really responding to my story or Kevin Smith's movies also meant something to them. So by the time we shot day one, I conceded to being in the film a little bit because I'd recently seen a mind-blowing film called Minding the Gap. But by the time Minding the Gap came out and other films that really showed a documentarian telling their personal story effectively and not in a self-aggrandizing way, I conceded to being in it for like 15 5 minutes. And the idea was just to anchor the movie in my real story. And then by the time we got to post-production, I think everybody figured out before I did that I would be in every scene of the movie and that the film was going to be about my life, which was not something I was emotionally prepared for. It felt vulnerable. It felt uncomfortable. And I also come out as trans in the movie. So I was not interested in preserving a part of myself that I didn't wish people would remember through an Instagram post, let alone a 92-minute movie going on the story of my life. But the other thing is that it's way better as a viewer of a movie or even as a filmmaker to explore coming of age through, I would say, fictitious circumstances where, you know, like it's a safe way to explore it. It's a lot different when it's you up there making mistakes, you know, having to be vulnerable. And so there was a lot of negotiation between me as the filmmaker and me as the storyteller, figuring out what I was comfortable with and what I wasn't comfortable with. And that is a testament, though, to having a great team around. And I'll never be able to thank all of them enough for what they did to make this movie what it is.
There's this quote from one of the people you interview for this film, and they say, quote, "Something that's problematic can still mean a lot in your development." And I think that's a great just central statement to this film, but also a lot of things in our lives. And you do dive into the problems that Chasing Amy presents both for audiences during its release and those who reflect on it today. So for people who are unfamiliar, can you give us a brief rundown of like the main criticisms of this film with the LGBTQ community?
Yeah, I mean, quickly, the person who said that is Princess Weeks, and she is a brilliant cultural critic. And she did like an op-ed about Chasing Amy and bisexuality, which is why I had reached out to her in the first place. And I love her interviews. It was one of my favorite experiences working on the film. Let's see, what makes Chasing Amy controversial today? So for context, Chasing Amy is a film by Kevin Smith released in 1997. It was released, you know, kind of during the heyday of new queer cinema. But because Kevin was, you know, this independent film wunderkind and a brilliant voice, when he made Chasing Amy, Miramax found a weekend where basically there was nothing counter-programmed that was really significant. And so Chasing Amy got a lot of attention. It made $12 million at the box office in 1997. That's a lot of money for an independent film or any film at the box office. And so it had this bigger cultural reach. It was a big rom-com at the time. Also, the internet was not nearly as popular. There were not op-eds, you know, so regularly written, let alone about something that would feel niche at the time, like, is Chasing Amy a problematic film? It just was a film of that time. And you watched a lot of films for the time and it shares similar hallmarks. One is the liberal use of slurs by the Becky character. People do not deem that that has aged well. But I think the biggest critique is that the central premise is it's about a straight man and a lesbian falling in love. And this, you know, it's seen as lesbian erasure. They never use the word bisexual in Chasing Amy. They don't use the word pansexual, but they do describe this fluidity of sexuality, which for a lot of people, they saw it as progressive. For some people, they saw it as reductive because they're not naming what it is. And I think this is kind of the perfect film in 2024 that would be correct for dissection in this current moment where we're trying to assess what does it mean for a film to not, quote unquote, age well? And is that a useful conversation? Is that an interesting conversation? But we are in this era of media reassessment, reboots, sequels, revisiting old IP. And that's the context in which Chasing Amy is being released into. So if people watch Chasing Amy today, try to watch it with the hat of what was it like in 1997 for somebody who was sympathetic to LGBTQ people and knew LGBTQ people trying to tell his own personal story, including them. And I think that's a more useful lens generally because, you know, it is a product of its time like any other film.
There's a lot of great interviews, including with actor and screenwriter Guinevere Turner, some other film critics, producers, and of course with the cast of Chasing Amy and Kevin Smith. But there's a particular nexus in the film, which is your interview with Joey Lauren Adams, who played Amy. And that was a big wake-up point and a big challenge for you. In the film, you said, "I had to, quote, sit there and grow up real fast" during that interview. So this kind of exemplifies like the challenges of looking at something retrospectively, right? So did the film's central direction change for you after that interview? You mentioned you had to step away from it for a little bit just to kind of process and take a minute.
100%. I mean, there were a number of reasons I stepped away from Chasing Amy for a minute, including the fact that my grandma was sick. I moved back to Kansas, but I think I did need some distance after that interview because, you know, there are a lot of truth bombs dropped in that interview. And the priority of both me and everybody who worked on the film was to make sure that we were integrating this interview as responsibly as we possibly could. You know, I think it took a lot of guts and a lot of bravery for Joey to share her experiences so openly. And I'm thankful that, you know, that day that she trusted us with her story. You know, it's not an easy thing to do, to sit there and be vulnerable. I know that intimately well from the process of making this movie and sitting through post-production on it. So yeah, it absolutely changed the central direction of the movie. And we tried to structure the entire movie around that moment to make sure that everything that you're seeing up until that point in the movie takes you on the journey that I was going on, so that when we do get to that moment, it has maximum impact, and that, you know, you understand the ways that, you know, her honesty is shaping my perspective and what my perspective was before for that moment. So I'm forever grateful to Joey for sharing her truth and being honest with us. I'll never be able to thank her enough.
After the Joey interview, as the direction changes and even more introspection happens, there's an interview you had with Kevin Smith, who you developed a great relationship with, like before, during, and I'm sure after this film. But he said to you, "You gave me my movie back." So I'm wondering, how did that feel to hear and process when you were coming away with a different outlook compared to when you had started this film?
You know, I think the journey contains a lot of multitudes. And one of those multitudes is that throughout the process of making this movie, I genuinely felt like Kevin was looking out for me and was open to a variety of uncomfortable conversations on camera. I mean, I think if you look at the questions I'm asking him, he's you know, it's not just like, "I love Chasing Amy. Can you tell me how much, you know, I should love Chasing Amy?" You know, there are some difficult questions I'm posing from, you know, other people's perspectives. And so to be able to have that open dialogue with him, for him to not be defensive throughout the entire process of conducting interviews was pretty amazing. So to hear something like, "You gave me my movie back," you know, even in the midst of like having difficult conversations about other people's reactions to it, I mean, that meant everything to me. You know, the idea that just engaging in, you know, memory work around Chasing Amy, even if they weren't always pleasant conversations, that it felt impactful to him in that moment. That was really touching, especially because Chasing Amy is the movie that made me want to become a filmmaker. So, you know, relationships to things evolve over time. You know, I don't need Chasing Amy the same way I did at age 12, and that is totally okay. What used to take up so much space now has been replaced by, you know, things like purpose and wanting to be a filmmaker. And, you know, for the last 20 years or so, I've been trying to tell this story. And now I have. And that's, I think, a nice full circle moment with it. So thank you, Kevin. Thank you, Joey. Thank you, everybody who made Chasing Amy and made any of it possible.
Well, Sav, I want to thank you for not only all the work that went into this documentary, but sharing yourself and sharing more about it today. Appreciate you.
Thank you so much, Audrey.
Sav Rogers is the director of Chasing Amy. You can see the last screening of its run in the Milwaukee Film Festival tomorrow afternoon. And you can find more information at WUWM.com. Milwaukee Film is a financial contributor to WUWM. A new season of Bubbler Talk is on the way, but ahead of that, we need some new questions. Submit your questions about the Milwaukee area at WUWM.com. Then, listen for new episodes starting in May on Thursdays during Lake Effect and Fridays during Morning Edition. We'll take one more break and then meet the director and subject of the documentary, Ahead of the Curve. Keep listening to Lake Effect on 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR. This is Like Effect on 89.7 WUWM. I'm Audrey Nowakowski. Today, there are multiple LGBTQ+ media outlets for people around the world to tap into and see themselves and their stories represented. But of course, this hasn't always been the case. When Franco Stevens realized she was a lesbian, there was hardly any representation of queer women. So, in 1990, she decided to change that and founded Curve, the best-selling lesbian lifestyle magazine. Curve has had a massive impact on lesbian visibility and culture, and it brought attention to problems that still persist in the LGBTQ community today. Stevens' legacy, the magazine's history, and its changing future is the subject of the new documentary, Ahead of the Curve. Franco Stevens and director Jen Rainin join me to share more. Rainin begins by explaining how this documentary came to be.
This story had been brewing for a number of years. As I got to know my wife in the early years of our marriage, she would tell me stories about, you know, the beginning of Curve magazine. And she would say things like, oh yeah, you know, it was hard to make payroll sometimes. So I used to have to go to loan sharks, or, oh, well, to get the money to start the magazine in the first place, I took out 12 credit cards in one day, cashed them all out, and went to the racetrack. And I thought, oh, this is good. This would make such a great movie. I should write the screenplay. So I started writing the screenplay. And in researching, I realized it was hard to find source material. It was hard to find really well-told nonfiction stories about us, about queer women, about our community, where we came from. And I started to realize that there was an imperative for me to tell this story as a nonfiction story first. So that's where it came from.
Well, Jen, you mentioned the story of Franco. You took out a bunch of credit cards and cashed them in and bet on and won some horse races in order to get the cash you needed to start a Denuve at the time. This was in 1990. And I'd say this is, you know, your determination is pretty evident throughout the history of your leadership at the magazine. So what was your big drive in creating this? And what was the culture climate like in your everyday lives as lesbians when you were trying to start this magazine? And the representation you did or did not see within media or print media?
Well, I virtually saw no representation in media. I think at the time, even The Advocate just said the gay men's magazine or gay men's news magazine or something like that. I really started the magazine because I wanted it, and I was tired of complaining that somebody else should do it. And once I really, you know, accepted the fact that this was sort of my fate, I just knew it was going to happen. I didn't, you know, I didn't take no for an answer. I didn't listen to anyone who said, you know, this is a bad idea. We put up a sign in the queer bookstore that I worked at, A Different Light in San Francisco, and just said writers and photographers wanted for a new lesbian magazine, little handwritten sign. And within a month, I had 300 calls. So I knew that other people wanted the magazine just like I did. And really, although I'm the movie subject, you know, the women and people behind the magazine really, you know, there's no way I could have done it by myself. Like, they were the lifeline of making magazine. Without those incredible group of women, really, there would be no Curve magazine 30 years later.
Right. And the documentary is not just an ode to lesbian culture and visibility, but of the massive team and community that was behind Curve and then hence got formed around Curve with readership. So clearly there was a need, still is a need for content. And when you were first putting out those initial editions, what mold were you trying to break?
You know, there were so many different molds that I was trying to break with those first issues. Really, it was about, like, we're just, I don't know how to say this delicately, like, we're just like everyday people, but we need our community in order to feel like we're not alone. I also wanted it to be, you know, color and glossy, at least on the cover at that point. I wanted it to be something that if, you know, your mom walked by and it was on the coffee table, you could feel proud that she picked it up and looked at it. Something to legitimize, I guess. I don't really like that word because I don't feel it's adequate, but that we are whole people and it's not just about sex for us. You know, I also wanted to know myself what was going on. You know, like, who are the musicians I should be listening to? And what is the culture like in, you know, various cities? And we had an article, I think, in one of the first issues that I think about a lot now because we live in California, which was wildfire firefighters that would go from, you know, wildfire to wildfire, putting these devastating fires out. And, you know, I think, God, where are those women today? Like, pretty great that Kirk could highlight women doing everyday things that are truly heroes in their, you know, for everybody.
You know what I also love when you talk about when you were coming out, how you kind of had to look a certain way in order to be accepted.
Yes, that's true. You know, like, you know, I'm a little bit butch of center, and I back then I would wear, you know, Doc Martens and Z Cavarucci jeans and a black leather jacket and cut my hair short. And you know, if you didn't look like that, you really weren't accepted into the lesbian community. And I just thought that was so wrong. Like, why do we have to, you know, fit a certain stereotype to be accepted by our own people? So that was one of the big things I tried to change by showing a variety of women in the magazine. And, you know, looking back on it, we definitely could have done better with portraying more women of color, more disabled people. And, you know, I know the work is not done there, that's for sure.
LGBTQ content is starting to become more consistent in mainstream media. Obviously, it's not the norm. But with this background and looking through this history throughout the documentary, what place do you believe lesbian magazines still hold, or does it need to shift?
I think there'll always be a place for our voices. You know, like, there's no one who can tell lesbian stories or queer stories like we can tell them. You know, there's a difference when the mainstream writes, you know, or shows a film or a TV show or a movie that's written by somebody that's outside of our community, than how it is when we write it and we you know, are portraying ourselves. One thing I must say about online platform is it gives so many more people a voice, mm-hmm. which is great.
And access.
Yeah,
and access stories mm-hmm. and find each other's stories. Mm-hmm.
But there's still this place, I think, for Curve or, you know, or what comes after Curve. We have to continue to tell our stories. And that's really where our motivation lies with the, you know, at the end of the film, we announced that we're going to be creating the Curve Foundation, which is to help our community continue to tell our stories.
Yeah, and on that note, while we can debate what spaces print magazines may or may not hold or what they can do in the future, I'm wondering what your prime priority right now is and the work you're doing. How are you using that momentum of this work you've done for so long to carry into the Kerr Foundation?
That's great. I think Jed can also pipe in here because I've been, you know, monopolizing the conversation.
And she's really interesting.
Says my wife.
Like, we're spending a lot of our time now thinking about and talking with community about how to create and build the Curve Foundation to carry on in the spirit of Curve Magazine, to carry on the work. It's just so critical for our community, for our culture, that we continue to tell and gather our stories. I mean, you know, queer women's history is a relatively recent thing. Well, it's not actually, but documenting it sure is. And, you know, it hasn't been safe to document until fairly recently. I mean, I think Cranko and her team went a long way toward making it much more safe, but there's so much more to do, so much more to do. So I think for the Kerr Foundation, we're thinking about lifting up these stories, finding the people who are wanting to tell our stories and lifting them up and supporting them and encouraging like cross-generational dialogue to connect the whole community to support this culture, create a space for this, for queer women, trans women, bisexual women, non-binary people, and lesbians, and everyone who feels a part of that community to connect with each other and share our stories and raise our visibility to create a space for us or to continue to do that.
Jen Rainin is the director and co-producer of the documentary Ahead of the Curve, and Franco Stevens is the lead cast and founder of Curve Magazine. They both joined me in 2020 when the film was in the virtual Milwaukee Film Festival. Ahead of the Curve is now available to watch on Netflix. You can find more information and an extended version of our original conversation at WUWM.com. And that's Lake Effect for today. I'm Audrey Nowakowski. If you've missed any of today's conversations or you'd like to take Lake Effect on the go, simply download our podcast. Search for Lake Effect wherever you get your podcasts to listen to all of our shows on demand. Tomorrow on Lake Effect, we'll continue celebrating Earth Day by exploring how one organization is making the outdoors more accessible for Indigenous youth. Plus, we'll learn about the Black Lens Shorts program. Join us again tomorrow at noon on Lake Effect, right here on listener-supported 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR.